Chapter 31. Fiercely, of some unknown and terrible crime, bids him never return to the confessional until contrition has touched his heart, and the stains which sully his spirit are, by sincere repentance, washed away. Thus speaking, says Angel, Father Hegesippus tore away his robe, which I was holding in my supplicating hands. In a sort of wildness I still grasped it tighter. He pushed me fiercely from him, and I fell with my face towards the ground. He quitted me, closing violently after him the door of the sacristy, in which this scene had passed. I was left alone in the darkness. Either from the violence of my fall, or the excess of my grief, a vein had burst in my throat, and a hemorrhage ensued. I had not the force to rise. I felt my senses rapidly sinking, and, presently, I lay stretched on the pavement, unconscious, and bathed in my blood. Now the wonderful part of the story begins. I know not how much time I passed in this way. As I came to myself, I felt an agreeable coolness. It seemed as if some harmonious air was playing round about me, stirring gently in my hair, and drying the drops of perspiration on my brow. It seemed to approach, and then again to withdraw, breathing now softly and sweetly in the distance, and now returning, as if to give me strength and courage to rise. I would not, however, do so as yet, for I felt myself, as I lay, under the influence of a pleasure quite new to me, and listened, in a kind of peaceful aberration, to the gentle murmurs of the summer wind, as it breathed on me through the closed window blinds above me. Then I fancied I heard a voice, that spoke to me from the end of the sacristy. It whispered so low, that I could not catch the words. I remained motionless, and gave it my whole attention. At last I heard, distinctly, the following sentence. Spirit of truth, raise up these victims of ignorance and imposture. ' Father Hegesippus, ' said I, in a weak voice, is that you who are returning to me? ', but no one answered. I lifted myself on my hands and knees, I listened again, but I heard nothing. I got up completely, and looked about me. I had fallen so near to the only door in this little room, that none, after the departure of the confessor, could have entered it without passing over me. Besides, the door was shut, and only opened from the inside by a strong lock of the ancient shape. I touched it, and assured myself that it was closed. I was seized with terror, and, for some moments, did not dare to move. Leaning against the door, I looked round, and endeavored to see into the gloom in which the angles of the room were enveloped. A pale light, which came from an upper window, half closed, was seen to be trembling in the midst of the apartment. The wind beat the shutter to and fro, and enlarged or diminished the space through which the light issued. The objects which were in this half-light, the praying desk, surmounted by its skull, a few books lying on the benches, a surplice hanging against the wall, seemed to move with the shadow of the foliage that the air agitated behind the window. When I thought I was alone, I felt ashamed of my former timidity. I made the sign of the cross, and was about to move forward in order to open the shutter altogether, but a deep sigh came from the praying desk, and kept me nailed to my place. And yet I saw the desk distinctly enough to be sure that no person was near it. Then I had an idea which gave me courage. Some person, I thought, is behind the shutter, and has been saying his prayers outside without thinking of me. But who would be so bold as to express such wishes, and utter such a prayer as I had just heard? Curiosity, the only passion and amusement permitted in a cloister, now entirely possessed me, and I advanced towards the window. But I had not made a step when a black shadow, as it seemed to me, detaching itself from the praying desk, traversed the room, directing itself towards the window, and passed swiftly by me. The movement was so rapid, that I had not time to avoid what seemed a body advancing towards me, and my fright was so great, that I thought I should faint a second time. But I felt nothing, and, as if the shadow had passed through me, I saw it suddenly disappear to my left. I rushed to the window, I pushed back the blind with precipitation, and looked round the sacristy. I was there, entirely alone. I looked into the garden, it was deserted, and the midday wind was wandering among the flowers. I took courage, I examined all the corners of the room, I looked behind the praying desk, which was very large, and I shook all the sacerdotal vestments which were hanging on the walls. Everything was in its natural condition, and could give me no explanation of what had just occurred. The sight of all the blood I had lost led me to fancy that my brain had, probably, been weakened by the hemorrhage, and that I had been a prey to some delusion. I retired to my cell, and remained shut up there until the next day. I don't know whether the reader has been as much struck with the above mysterious scene as the writer has, but the fancy of it strikes me as very fine, and the natural supernaturalness is kept up in the best style. The shutter swaying to and fro, the fitful light appearing over the furniture of the room, and giving it an air of strange motion, the awful shadow which passed through the body of the timid young novice are surely very finely painted. Rushed to the shutter, and flung it back. There was no one in the sacristy. I looked into the garden, it was deserted, and the midday wind was roaming among the flowers. The dreariness is wonderfully described. Only the poor pale boy looking eagerly out from the window of the sacristy, and the hot midday wind walking in the solitary garden. How skillfully is each of these little strokes dashed in, and how well do all together combine to make a picture. But we must have a little more about Spiridion's wonderful visitant. As I entered into the garden, I stepped a little on one side, to make way for a person whom I saw before me. He was a young man of surprising beauty, and attired in a foreign costume. Although dressed in the large black robe which the superiors of our order wear, he had, underneath, a short jacket of fine cloth, fastened round the waist by a leathern belt, and a buckle of silver, after the manner of the old German students. Like them, he wore, instead of the sandals of our monks, short tight boots, and over the collar of his shirt, which fell on his shoulders, and was as white as snow, hung, in rich golden curls, the most beautiful hair I ever saw. He was tall, and his elegant posture seemed to reveal to me that he was in the habit of commanding. With much respect, and yet uncertain, I half saluted him. He did not return my salute, but he smiled on me with so benevolent an air, and at the same time, his eyes severe and blue, looked towards me with an expression of such compassionate tenderness, that his features have never, since then, passed away from my recollection. I stopped, hoping he would speak to me, and persuading myself, from the majesty of his aspect, that he had the power to protect me. But the monk, who was walking behind me, and who did not seem to remark him in the least, forced him brutally to step aside from the walk, and pushed me so rudely as, almost to cause me to fall. Not wishing to engage in a quarrel with this coarse monk, I moved away, but, after having taken a few steps in the garden, I looked back, and saw the unknown still gazing on me with looks of the tenderest solicitude. The sun shone full upon him, and made his hair look radiant. He sighed, and lifted his fine eyes to heaven, as if to invoke its justice in my favor, and to call it to bear witness to my misery. He turned slowly towards the sanctuary, entered into the choir, and was lost, presently, in the shade. I longed to return, spite of the monk, to follow this noble stranger, and to tell him my afflictions. But who was he, that I imagined he would listen to them, and cause them to cease? I felt, even while his softness drew me towards him, that he still inspired me with a kind of fear, for I saw in his physiognomy as much austerity as sweetness. Who was he? We shall see that. He was somebody very mysterious indeed, but our author has taken care, after the manner of her sex, to make a very pretty fellow of him, and to dress him in the most becoming costumes possible. The individual in tight boots and a rolling collar, with the copious golden locks, and the solemn blue eyes, who had just gazed on Spiridion, and inspired him with such a feeling of tender awe, is a much more important personage than the reader might suppose at first sight. This beautiful, mysterious, dandy ghost, whose costume, with a true woman's coquetry, Madame Dudevant has so rejoiced to describe, is her religious type, a mystical representation of faith struggling up towards truth, through superstition, doubt, fear, reason, and tight inexpressibles, with a belt such as is worn by the old German students. You will pardon me for treating such an awful person as this somewhat lightly, but there is always, I think, such a dash of the ridiculous in the French sublime, that the critic should try and do justice to both, or he may fail in giving a fair account of either. This character of Hebronius, the type of Mrs. Sand's convictions, if convictions they may be called, or, at least, the allegory under which her doubts are represented, is, in parts, very finely drawn, contains many passages of truth, very deep and touching, by the side of others so entirely absurd and unreasonable, that the reader's feelings are continually swaying between admiration, and something very like contempt, always in a kind of wonder at the strange mixture before him. But let us hear Madame Sand. Peter Hebronius, says our author, was not originally so named. His real name was Samuel. He was a Jew, and born in a little village in the neighborhood of Innsbruck. His family, which possessed a considerable fortune, left him, in his early youth, completely free to his own pursuits. From infancy he had shown that these were serious. He loved to be alone, and passed his days, and sometimes his nights, wandering among the mountains and valleys in the neighborhood of his birthplace. He would often sit by the brink of torrents, listening to the voice of their waters, and endeavoring to penetrate the meaning which nature had hidden in those sounds. As he advanced in years, his inquiries became more curious and more grave. It was necessary that he should receive a solid education, and his parents sent him to study in the German universities. Luther had been dead only a century, and his words and his memory still lived in the enthusiasm of his disciples. The new faith was strengthening the conquests it had made. The reformers were as ardent as in the first days, but their ardor was more enlightened and more measured. Proselytism was still carried on with zeal, and new converts were made every day. In listening to the morality, and to the dogmas which Lutheranism had taken from Catholicism, Samuel was filled with admiration. His bold and sincere spirit instantly compared the doctrines which were now submitted to him, with those in the belief of which he had been bred, and, enlightened by the comparison, was not slow to acknowledge the inferiority of Judaism. He said to himself, that a religion made for a single people, to the exclusion of all others, which only offered a barbarous justice for a rule of conduct, which neither rendered the present intelligible nor satisfactory, and left the future uncertain, could not be that of noble souls and lofty intellects, and that he could not be the God of truth who had dictated, in the midst of thunder, his vacillating will, and had called to the performance of his narrow wishes the slaves of a vulgar terror. Always conversant with himself, Samuel, who had spoken what he thought, now performed what he had spoken, and, a year after his arrival in Germany, solemnly abjured Judaism, and entered into the bosom of the Reformed Church. As he did not wish to do things by halves, and desired as much as was in him to put off the old man and lead a new life, he changed his name of Samuel to that of Peter. Some time passed, during which he strengthened and instructed himself in his new religion. Very soon he arrived at the point of searching for objections to refute, and adversaries to overthrow. Bold and enterprising, he went at once to the strongest, and Bossuet was the first Catholic author that he set himself to read. He commenced with a kind of disdain, believing that the faith which he had just embraced contained the pure truth. He despised all the attacks which could be made against it, and laughed already at the irresistible arguments which he was to find in the works of the Eagle of Mo. But his mistrust and irony soon gave place to wonder first, and then to admiration. He thought that the cause pleaded by such an advocate must, at least, be respectable, and, by a natural transition, came to think that great geniuses would only devote themselves to that which was great. He then studied Catholicism with the same ardor and impartiality which he had bestowed on Lutheranism. He went into France, to gain instruction from the professors of the Mother Church, as he had from the doctors of the Reformed Creed in Germany. He saw Arnold Fenelon, that second Gregory of Nazianzen, and Bossuet himself. Guided by these masters, whose virtues made him appreciate their talents the more, he rapidly penetrated to the depth of the mysteries of the Catholic doctrine and morality. He found, in this religion, all that had for him constituted the grandeur and beauty of Protestantism, the dogmas of the unity and eternity of God, which the two religions had borrowed from Judaism, and, what seemed the natural consequence of the last doctrine, a doctrine, however, to which the Jews had not arrived, the doctrine of the immortality of the soul, free will in this life, in the next, recompense for the good, and punishment for the evil. He found, more pure, perhaps, and more elevated in Catholicism than in Protestantism, that sublime morality which preaches equality to man, fraternity, love, charity, renouncement of self, devotion to your neighbor. Catholicism, in a word, seemed to possess that vast formula, and that vigorous unity, which Lutheranism wanted. The latter had, indeed, in its favor, the liberty of inquiry, which is also a want of the human mind, and had proclaimed the authority of individual reason. But it had so lost that which is the necessary basis and vital condition of all revealed religion, the principle of infallibility, because nothing can live except in virtue of the laws that presided at its birth, and, in consequence, one revelation cannot be continued and confirmed without another. Now, infallibility is nothing but revelation continued by God, or the Word, in the person of his vicars. At last, after much reflection, Hebronius acknowledged himself entirely and sincerely convinced, and received baptism from the hands of Bossuet. He added the name of Spiridion to that of Peter, to signify that he had been twice enlightened by the Spirit. Resolved thenceforward to consecrate his life to the worship of the new God who had called him to him, and to the study of his doctrines, he passed into Italy, and, with the aid of a large fortune, which one of his uncles, a Catholic like himself, had left to him, he built this convent where we now are. A friend of mine, who has just come from Italy, says that he has there left Messrs. S.P.R., P.L., and W. Dr. D., who were the lights of the great church in Newman Street, who were themselves apostles, and declared and believed that every word of nonsense which fell from their lips was a direct spiritual intervention. These gentlemen have become Puseyites already, and are, my friend states, in the highway to Catholicism. Madame Sand herself was a Catholic some time since, having been converted to that faith along with M.N., of the Academy of Music, Mr. 50, the pianoforte player, and one or two other chosen individuals, by the famous Abdullah M. Abdullah M., so told me in the diligence, a priest, who read his breviary and gossiped alternately very curiously and pleasantly, is himself an name perjue. The man spoke of his brother clergyman with actual horror, and it certainly appears that the Abbe's works of conversion have not prospered. For Madame Sand, having brought her hero and herself, as we may presume, to the point of Catholicism, proceeds directly to dispose of that as he has done of Judaism and Protestantism, and will not leave, of the whole fabric of Christianity, a single stone standing. I think the fate of our English Newman Street apostles, and of M. de la M., the mad priest, and his congregation of mad converts, should be a warning to such of us as are inclined to dabble in religious speculations. For, in them, as in all others, our flighty brains soon lose themselves, and we find our reason speedily lying prostrated at the mercy of our passions. And I think that Madame Sand's novel of Spiridion may do a vast deal of good, and bears a good moral with it, though not such an one, perhaps, as our fair philosopher intended. For anything he learned, Samuel Peter Spiridion Hebronius might have remained a Jew from the beginning to the end. Wherefore be in such a hurry to set up new faiths? Wherefore, Madame Sand, try and be so preternaturally wise? Wherefore be so eager to jump out of one religion, for the purpose of jumping into another? See what good this philosophical friskiness has done you, and on what sort of ground you are come at. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.